If you didn't want to go to work for them in the first place, when they had to talk you into it, why were you there that long?
Well, because I'm just an exuberant guy, you know. Whatever I do, I get exuberant, and it's a great program to develop the West through water resource development. And so I was at Coulee Dam and helping with the visitors and writing press releases and doing these things, and Washington, D.C. called up and said, would I like to come to Washington, D.C. and go to work as chief of publications, except there were no publications during the war. And I accepted, which everybody told me at Coulee Dam I was stupid. So I was back there working with Harold Ickes, among others. And then they moved me back to Coulee, and then they moved me back to Boise, where I became regional information officer. But it was so close to newspapering that it was one and the same. It was just as pleasant an experience as reporting, almost, except that you got lambasted by such outfits as the Idaho Power Company, you know.
Now, you mentioned earlier that that the Bureau of Reclamation left you. What's that about?
Well, I have always been very strong-minded since my college days about the importance of the people's right to know. I wound up as national chairman of a Freedom Information Committee for 3 years in connection with that. In Idaho, the Bureau of Reclamation was proposing the construction of a Hell's Canyon Dam, a dam about 500 feet high in the spectacular Canyon of the Snake. The Idaho Power Company didn't want any public power in the state, so they fought it, saying that they would build two little dams, which we call beaver dams, and telling the people that you could get just as much power from two dams without any storage as you could from a storage dam, which is utterly ridiculous. Their slogan was, keep Idaho people green. But whenever there was a request from a Grange or a group for someone to speak on the Bureau, I spoke. The regional director didn't. I spoke. I never avoided it. I thought it was important that the people know what the plans of their government was. Well, then when the election came, Eisenhower got in, the order came that I had to be fired, and the Bureau wanted to keep me and did offer me a job of report writing, but I refused that because I'm a newspaper man, not a report writing. And I got fired, ultimately, but because having spoken out, you know, it was due to the fact of a congressman named Budge, who was a stooge of the Idaho Power Company. And when he was defeated, I'm not a vindictive person. I don't hold grudges, really, except in that instance. And I sent him a wire, says, that's the best thing that happened to Idaho since Lewis and Clark. Kind of nasty, but couldn't help but do that. And they even followed me out. I was to become publicity director for the nation's sugar beet industry. That's all approved by everybody. The board of 11 companies and the Idaho Power Company told them I was against free enterprise, and I lost a job. Heck of a big job, but I'm glad it happened because I've had so much more fun at a lesser salary in the newspaper business.
You told me before that you had a couple of opportunities to encounter Harry Truman. And, you know, I'm leading up to a particular story here because Truman used to refer to his wife as the boss and at least publicly seemed to defer to her. But you were telling about an instance where she wouldn't wear a hat?
No, that involved his daughter, Margaret.
Oh, all right.
I was in charge of the dedication of Grand Coulee Dam and earlier of the Hungry Horse Dam. Planning the thing, working with the Secret Service. And when Harry Truman came, I had a hard hat made up from him, being publicity-minded, on behalf of my agency, which said Harry on it. And the president put it on right away, and it was printed in Time magazine. We had one called Margaret, labeled Margaret, but she refused to put it on, and the president said, Margaret, you put that on. And she did. He was such a common guy, very likable guy, you know. And I was on the train with him. He just, all you read about him, I think, is true.
The train, what was the logistics of that dedication day to get him?
He was going to go by train from Hungry Horse, which is in western Montana, through Spokane, and so on. You know, the president used to travel and speak from the back platform. In fact, one time I was assigned to the White House, which does not mean you're in the White House, but you work nearby, to prepare an album for the Northwest, so that when he got off, about to get off on the back platform, you know, say Boise, he could just see and say, he could say, in reading the album, oh, how delightful it is to get out of this dreary, strange brush and then these beautiful green of the Boise Valley and so on, you know. So I've been with him a couple times, with him at Grand Coulee Dam, too.
You mentioned, you know, we see today governors, presidents, senators flying over disaster sites or whatever, but in the great flood of 48, Truman come out here then? Was that it?
Yeah, he was out here in 48, and I went with him to Vancouver, where there was a new city built called Vanport. And the Columbia River, you remember, in 48, had that tremendous flood, which brought on all the storage dams we have today. And so it flooded that area, and all the houses were floating, and Truman, he walked right on the top of a roof of a house, which the Secret Service was a little disturbed about because they're so finicky about him, particularly, you know, also what he eats and all that stuff. That experience with another president about talking about eating, FDR came to Cooley, and when he was leaving, he saw a hamburger stand and said, stop, I want to get a hamburger. So he got a hamburger, which has not been tested as to purity, of course, and later on the guy put up, changed the name of the place and enabled President's Choice.
Why not? Uh-huh. Another thing you mentioned earlier and we were talking was being chairman of a National Freedom of Information Committee or something?
Yeah.
What was that?
There's an organization called Associated Press Managed Editors Association, which is an organization of managed editors of papers that take to Associated Press, like the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, and Chicago Tribune, and papers as small as us. And I was on their Freedom of Information Committee, and very excited about the people's right to know. So when the chairman one year couldn't do his job because of labor trouble, they called me up, and would I be chairman? I said, sure. And our objective was to keep all offices open, particularly the courts. At that time, there was a committee of the American Bar Association called the Reardon Committee, which proposed that courtrooms be closed a great deal of the time, that if a lawyer spoke to the press, he'd be cited for contempt of court, and police chiefs wouldn't be limited in what they could say. So our committee fought that intensely, and at the time I was also a member of the State Bench Bar Press Committee, which through voluntary means is protecting the people's right to know and also the right of a person to have a fair trial. But I think the most satisfying part of that 3 years as chairman of that national committee and 4 years of vice chairman was to help bring about the Freedom of Information Act. I don't want to brag, but I am proud that I was listed in the Congressional Record as one of the editors who helped bring that about. And you know how valuable that is now. There's all of this secrecy we used to have in the government can't be practiced so freely anymore.
One of the provisions of that is that now a citizen can write to the federal government or to a particular branch, and say, I want to know what you guys have on file about me.
That's right. That's one of the key things. And of course, the president now is trying to weaken that act. And I don't know whether he's going to succeed or not. Some of us are continuing to fight that. But it's important, I think, in democracy, the people know what's going on behind the doors of the school board, the county commissioners, in our courts, in relation to and other public agency. In relation to the courts, I think the press needs to show some restraint. If someone confesses to something, it may not be admitted into the trial. If someone, this is an actual case, takes the police out and shows the body at index, a couple of bodies at index, nothing wrong with running that. But I don't agree that we need to again run that confession at the time they're picking the jury, so that the jury might be influenced. So I'm an advocate of restraint. As long as we have the power to do it, we haven't lost much, but I think we need to show restraint.
More in a moment. To ask a little bit about coming on board with the world on a full-time basis, when that happened and how did that happen? Were you had been fired from the Bureau of Reclamation?
Yes, I was going to go to Iran and be an assistant director of the Point 4 program, but my wife wasn't feeling well, so I turned it down. But I had never been out of work a day in my life, and a month of that or 2 months of that just drive me crazy. And boys, so I wrote Wilford Woods and said, "Wilford, haven't you got something for me to do?" I said, "I don't care what you pay me. I'll sweep out the joint. I just want to be doing something." So he says, "Come on over." And I came over, and, you know, the first place I came to do stories was into Chelan. And I wound up in a day with four feature stories. I've always been lucky. I've had a nose for news. I seem to always find them. And within about less than a week, he said, "How about coming to work for me?" And I said, "No, Wilford, there isn't any money in newspapering." He said, "Oh, maybe there is." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll decide the minimum I'll take, and then you decide the maximum you can pay. If they match up, fine. If they don't match up, we're still good friends, you know." And they matched up. That's how I wound up there.
Simple as that.
Yeah. Of course, they knew of me, and they could see from my experience in Chelan the first day I hadn't lost much being in the government. I originally turned the Bureau of Reclamation down for a job because I said, 2 years in the government, you're not worth a darn.
What were those first feature stories that you filed?
Oh, I've forgotten that, Steve. I just don't remember what they were.
Your job right now, I want to talk about some of the intervening time, but your job right now, what you're doing now, seems to me to be just idealistic. You couldn't ask for a better deal.
No, it isn't. I've always felt that newspapering was a hobby. In fact, I tell young kids at career day, whatever you do, get a job you enjoy. Don't worship a job that pays a lot of money but you're unhappy. And with me, newspaper has been a hobby. So when I retired, the boss said, write all you want to. So I write all I want to, which is frequently. I must work about 65 hours a month, but no study schedule. I have a desk down there. You know, I don't have a computer. I use other people's computer. And it's just ideal, you know. Today, I don't know where I'm going, but I think from here I may go to Grand Coulee Dam and do some writing. And no one can have it better than that.
You are mixing a good deal of travel with your writing. I see that you've been up this mountain or down that mountain.
Yeah, but that's kind of misleading. I grew up all these years, when I'd go 2 days, I've averaged 5 feature stories. And it's a challenge now because I'm 76 to keep doing that. And so I write that many stories. But they don't run them all the time. In fact, I have a story in there, my trip to England, which I took 5 weeks ago and still hasn't run. So it looks like I'm dashing to Winthrop. The next 5 days later, I'm dashing to Winthrop again, when actually a lot of those stories are gotten on a single trip.
The stuff you are writing is on file there and ready to go, or apparently.
That's right.
They have the space available. Is it?
That's kind of, you know, that's the reason the stuff in England hasn't run. I just finished a story on a guy in Plain who is an artist up there and world renowned for stained glass, which I wrote up some time ago, but now he's made an unusual chapel, the most unusual chapel in the world for a Chicago hospital, and that's still laying around, and I don't know, there's another one or two laying around down there.
You mentioned computers. You don't have one on your desk. You borrow someone else's. There has certainly been some phenomenal changes in the newspapering business, as most businesses over the past few years, numbers of years. As you look back in your career with the world, what are the milestone sorts of changes that really changed the way or the tools that you might use?
Well, the first change was going from hot lead. You know, we used to, each line of type, we call it, each line in the column would be an individual piece of hot lead which came through a linotype. And then it was be assembled and pounded. So it's all even. And that disappeared, 30 years ago, I suppose, and gave way to offset, where each letter is photographed. Each letter in the natural world, individually photographed. And then it comes out in column form, and they run it through a waxer, and then they paste it up. It's called offset. And ultimately, that negative is taken the whole page, and it's that negative is printed on aluminum, and the aluminum is put on the press. That's what the paper is printed from now. The other thing I think is the computer. We type our stuff on what amounts to a little screen, and I, not being mechanically inclined at the outset, I lost some stories. And I'm really still cowardly, because the minute I get something in the machine, I put it through a line printer, so I have a hard copy to go for. And it's been valuable to me sometime. But it's much faster to write stories. But I think you're more sloppy in your original version because you're easy to change things. With a typewriter, you know, which you had to erase it. Incidentally, the typewriter that I use in Grand Coulee, which has a dent in the spacebar when my thumb hit it, I still have at home. And I'm really still a typewriter boy, I think, at heart.
I'm having a little trouble with the conversion myself. Scott, do you have one?
we still use typewriters here. Hugh was saying, you know, you asked about the tools of change, and I just left the room a moment ago to go get another cup of coffee, do the third cup here. Tools haven't changed that much. Sticking out of his back pocket is a notepad.
Yeah, you still use those, but I find that I have to write more notes now. My memory isn't as good as it used to be, you know. And so I take a lot of notes.
Hugh, in your career, is there a story or stories that just reach out and grab your memory where you say, I was so scared on that one or so emotionally charged on that story that it really stands out?
Well, I remember one story where I went in for the sheriff's posse. I call this the saddest story I ever wrote. There were three prominent orchards in the wintertime had flown a plane and disappeared over Snoqualmie Pass. A hiker found the bodies up there, and I went up with the sheriff from Kittitas. And it was a gruesome sight. The plane was on a slope, and chunks of bodies were laying around. And, well, I guess I should say it, just covered with maggots. And animals had hauled it away. And they had big black bags that they put the bodies in. Dr. Fager was there, and I remember him saying one time, you, how many left arms we got, you know. And then when they got everything they could find in the black bags, I went down the hill with others and stopped at the trail because the horses were coming. And there came those three horses, you know, containing the remains of once happy human beings. And then they went past us and disappeared down the trail. That's one of the most memorable sights that I've ever experienced in newspapering. Yeah, I couldn't eat my lunch up there, I'll tell you that. Then you have stories that are fun. I think the funniest story was a chief of police called me, and you see, I was managing editor, but I still wrote a lot, even when I was managing editor, because I really wanted to be a writer, not a managing editor. He called me up, and he says, there's a funny story up here. He says, some Mexican guys came out of a bar, and near this two-story house were some young girls up there, and they got the kidding back and forth. And pretty soon, one of the Mexican boys went on the roof and went down the chimney. In Mexico, you know, there are no stoves down below, I guess. So he goes in the chimney. When Grandpa's down there in the kitchen, all of a sudden, hears all that hollering and yelling from inside the chimney down there. So they had to break a hole through the chimney and get him out. Well, they had taken the Mexican to jail, and I said, gee, Chuck, police, I said, got to get the guy back there. I got to get a picture of that. And the Mexican wasn't about to go. But I call it the case of the Latin lover or something. But, you know, I got some nasty mail over that because they said, what if these Mexicans have raped these girls, you know? And then one of the most satisfying story that you'll appreciate, Steve, is the story on Gordon Stewart, you know. And he refuses, as you both know, to talk about it. And finally, just as he's about to die, he let me do that story. And it's drawn a lot of comment. And I know he was close to you. But when I interviewed him, he was feeling so bad then. He had emphysema, high blood pressure, heart condition, you name it, he had it. And he had a hair lip to begin with. And so no one could understand him, including Stan Bryant, who was his close friend from Manassas. So that the interview had to be done through Sandy Nelson, who was taken care of, might ask a question, she'd answer. And before that, I had offered to write the story and let him see it, and he went, poof. And I said, I tell you, Gordon, what we'll do, I'll write the story, and we won't run it till you die. And he said, what would you get out of that? He glared at me. And I said, Gordon, it's like I've been telling you, you're a legend. Your story ought to be told. It's not going to happen in America again. And later he told someone, he says, you don't believe that fellow would do that. So when I heard they were going to drop these helicopter loads of lumber down to build a cabin, I went in. And the girls were very protective, and they saw my camera and said, you better see Gordon. So I went in to see Gordon. He was then not able to navigate. And he talked to me, even let me take his picture. And I agreed to send it to him. And many people have said, and I've never even had this in our paper, have said, isn't it too bad he never got to read what you wrote? And I said, Gordon did get to read what you wrote. I sent it to him 3 weeks, and he kept it 3 weeks, and I thought he wasn't going to return it, but he came back, and she wrote for him, said, fine. And so we ran it, and he did get to see it. The paper kept it a week, and then, as you know, the day it appeared is the day that he died. So my original agreement with him still became true. I didn't run until he died.
Did he make, or did Sandy or someone make any changes in that?
No, just a couple words. I forgot some minor thing. It didn't amount to anything. No contact. I had told him, I said, now, Gordon, I said, don't let me write this, and you've already made up your mind not to approve it. But I think he knew he was going to pass on. Yeah. He was quite a guy, wasn't he?
Well done story.
And the thing that broke, that I disliked about it, it's so much more to be told about Gordon, as you personally know. But I didn't want to put too much in there, because the more I put in there, the more my chances were that he wouldn't approve it, you know.
Yeah, he wouldn't approve it, and also you've got the same problem, you know, that we do sometimes with time constraints. The bigger and longer you make it, the more chances that things are going to be added to the shot.
Yeah, they didn't edit this one, but because that could have run longer, or it could have run a second edition, because he had a tremendous number of friends. Gordon did.
More in a moment, second.
Good morning, Steve, everybody. Another beautiful morning here. We're just coming into the straits, and again, as I look the 18 miles up the stretch, it's just a great big mirror. Absolutely magnificent with the current outside temperature already of 74 degrees. Going to be another warm one.
The drift situation still down lake from Lucerne, area of the fire, and in the yacht club, most of the drift congregating those areas?
You're pretty much right there, although we should exercise some caution in the... Let's see, from point to no point down to probably Safety Harbor Creek. There's good amounts, good size stuff in there.
Okay, thanks. We'll check with you later.
Hey, we're joined this morning, Radio Lakes Lands, Jer Eisenhart. Morning, boss.
Morning. Do you want to say thank you for being here? Delightful conversation this morning.
Thank you.
You know, in listening to you talk, thought perhaps it might be fun to talk about something, and I should have asked you perhaps during the break whether we should even talk about this, but as a newspaper man, you would appreciate this. In our business, we call them bloopers. In your business, they're misprints. I recall in the 1950s, I believe, perhaps what was the last big blooper in the Wenatchee world until recently, but it was a blooper in which it was at apple blossom time, and the headline said, meant to say, horses viewed at Appalachian grounds, and it actually said HORS viewed at Appalachian grounds. Do you recall that?
No, I don't recall it, but I don't recall having seen it personally, but I remember, because you remember those bloopers, you know. We had a blooper in classified advertising one time, whereby a lady advertised for work at her home at night. Now, the ad was perfect, perfectly, but it appeared in the wrong column. And she sued us because she got all kinds of phone calls and was emotionally upset. She was looking for work at her home, and it came out under breeding stock. Column 73. But you know, when you handle so many stories, so many things.
Okay.
Oh, you know, there's all kinds of stories about a friend of mine had a headline that the miners went to back to work after strike, and the military was there, and they went back to work, and his headline said, "Miners return to pits under arms."
Well, let me pursue the blooper issue just a moment.
Okay,
yeah, and then we'll
ahead.
Do that. I think in some cases it's probably more appropriate just to forget that they happen. How do you treat a major blooper? How does the world treat a major blooper, as we saw here recently? And that's all we need to say about it.
This recent one, there was no way we could say anything to the public. You know, there's no way to explain that. Thing happened, wouldn't happen in a million years, but any others, why, it's corrected, of course. One time they had something in the paper in Rufus's days, I was told, that they call a prominent lady, in effect, a prostitute, you know, somebody horsing around, and boy, they sent the trucks out and got all the papers back when it was spotted, you know. That's why I never like to see anybody fooling around with an April Fool's Day. You can get burned something terrible, you know, by people that read it and take it seriously. But in our profession, we're going to have these. Luckily, you fellas, they can't keep carrying it in their billfolds forever, you know, as they will in this instance. We're all very bad about it. Unbelievable.
What happens internally when you suddenly discover there's a misprint that's significant? It may not even be funny. It may be serious, but in either case, it's a misprint that you truly regret. What happens internally within the organization?
Well, I don't think anybody's ever been fired over it unless it's done purposely, and I can mention a case of that kind. Because it's a human error, you know, and the person may have been there 10 years and never made an error. Might have typed the word wrong. We had one where a controller came up and said, they tell me you keep your name out of the paper. And I said, not a word of truth to it, except I said it much more violently than that, you know. Well, so-and-so kept the name out of the paper. I said, it's not true. But I brought the reporter in. She said something about drunken driving, see? And we couldn't find it. The reporter said, well, I turned it out. And it just emotionally upset me because I was under suspicion. The reporter was under suspicion. Everybody associated with it. So I told the boss, I said, let's give people lie detector tests. Let's find out who did this. It turned out two friends of in the composing room were friends of these people, this person cited, and they threw it out. And some of us wanted them fired, but the publisher never did, because he's such a nice guy, as you know. One fellow said, if you don't fire him for that, what will you fire him for? But you know, that's fooling around. And just another case, had an item about a prominent advertiser's son being involved in a wreck, and it said, then he slugged the policeman in the nose. And I brought the reporter in, because the guy came in, and it wasn't true. Someone downstairs, there was a friend of this guy, and just added that and was going to show him the clipping, see, and then forgot to pull it out.
Okay, so those kinds of things.
We know if it's just a human error, why, there's not much you can do about it. If there's any hanky panky like I just described to you, that's something else.
Okay, just let me back up in your conversation. I'm sorry I wasn't here earlier, but you were talking about some of the events at Grand Coulee, and I couldn't help but remember perhaps one of the most interesting stories that I heard out of Grand Coulee was that people actually, under the guise perhaps of a prank, would nail boots to the insides of the forms, and then as they poured them full of concrete, what you'd have is a concrete wall with a pair of boots sticking out. Do you recall if that was actually true?
I've never heard this story, and I would doubt it very much, because the government has inspectors in every block, and they would never allow such hanky-panky. I couldn't say if, and there were 8,800 men on the job, that somebody didn't do something like that, but I never heard of it before.
Sure.
Earlier in your conversation, we were talking about the press and credibility. You sometimes look at the young upstart new reporter that is just to sign on to the paper and go, oh, and give an opportunity to sit down and talk to some of these individuals.
And of course, I miss that now, not training young people anymore. But some of them are overcome by excitement, and I'd be the last guy in the world to ever say, don't be so aggressive, But young people, you have to train, just like in your profession, I presume. And I've always said that, and I used to hire the best kids I could get out of University of Washington or other places, but it still takes them 2 years to become a real pro. And during that time, they're going to make errors. Very strong about name errors. The most precious thing about a person is his name. Which reminds me, when I missed a question at UW, the professor said, now, Mr. Blank. But I never liked it, But some many come out of school, and I can't say that in the last 10 years because I haven't handled it, error prone. If I hear somebody take a name over the phone to this day, and they don't say G like in good, B like in Boston, Z like in zebra, I shy away. I just cringe because I know somewhere along the line they're going to make a mistake. Even Smith can be spelled with a Y, And so you have to make sure that they follow a pattern that leads to accuracy. If they don't do that, then I would really roar. I was never considered a mild managing editor, A TV station once called me crusty.
Did you, back when you were the managing editor, did you see some of those younger folks that were coming up and they had a story, an assignment or something, and you wanted to go out there? I want to do that myself. I know I can go do that. I can do it better.
Oh, you bet, and I used to do that because I like to write, Like the story on Quincy of that Mexican going down the chimney I did, and the one of the up in the mountains with the bodies, and I wrote more than I should have, I think. But I really am a writer, and a managing editor just pays more money,
More in just a moment, second.
Skill at all in the wintertime. I was called by the Humane Society, rushed down to Fifth Street, had my old speed graphic and got it in focus, got the plate out and shot the picture. Life used it as one of the top picture of the week. They called a doe on the flow. It showed a deer with its ear extended upward on a cake of ice floating down the Columbia River. Those are the kind of things you remember, you know. It's like some scoop you fellas have, you know, I presume.
Sure. The story that was done in the mid-50s, and it was basically about some raccoons that my family raised. And I remember it from a different reason, because I learned a new word. The word was mischievous. He was referring to the raccoons, but I've been that way ever since.
That's probably only three-syllable word I know. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed.
No, not where you're going, but wherever it is you'll be riding before the day's over.
That's right.
Appreciate
thank you very much.
Nope. Thank you for joining us. Delight to have you.
Glad to have you.